on the idea that Sandin would clean up and that punk music would ever be popular enough to be profitable never would have seemed like a smart gamble. But it's hard not to occasionally kick myself, knowing that if I'd stuck it out for one more album, I could have tripled my income. I still get a check every now and then, but they don't come as often or as big as they used to. 18 years after I quit, I finally joined NoFX on stage again, in 2009 at their 25th anniversary shows in San Francisco and L.A. I felt nothing but accepted and welcomed by the fans, and especially by the guys in the band, who I'm lucky to still consider my friends. My wife finally got to see me play NoFX songs live, and I have to admit it was a rush being able to perform again. I got paid more in one night for the anniversary shows than I did on an entire tour in 1990. I tried to convince Mike to do an anniversary tour, just a few extra dates on the East Coast, but I guess it wasn't meant to be. But ultimately, I believe there's a larger plan, and it's not Fat Mike's. I'm happy with my contribution to the band, and I'm appreciative of the fact that it made me some money and allowed me more travel than I ever would have undertaken on my own. I'm also happy with where I am today. With my music career mostly behind me, I became a tattoo artist and eventually moved my growing family back to Merced. My kids enjoy making fun of me in old NoFX live videos on YouTube, and I've taught my son to play most of the songs from S&M Airlines and Ribbed on guitar. It's a good life, and every now and then I'll get a tattoo client who turns out to be a NoFX fan. "Oh, dude! You played on Punk and Drublick?" A little before that. "Oh, White Trash, Two Ebes and a Bean?" Before that. Oh.
Chapter 53, Smelly. The closest I've ever come to suicide was during our third European tour. The deeper I got into my addiction, the more severe my dope sickness became when I couldn't score. My junkie radar helped me hone in on users, and I'd follow them to figure out who the dealers were, and find dealers trusting enough to sell drugs to an unknown customer. But there were plenty of times when I came up dry. The sickness I felt during my first withdrawals at my parents' house for Christmas came back with a vengeance. It was 6 a.m., somewhere in northern Germany, and I couldn't fucking sleep. We were staying in some shitty squat with no heat, so I was freezing. And my hard, lumpy bed was secluded from the rest of the band in some supply closet. It would have been hard to sleep in those conditions anyways, but the aches and nausea and illogical sweating made the experience unbearable. It's the only time I seriously thought, okay, I could kill myself. It seemed like a reasonable course of action. Suffering through that night was not a possibility. Quitting heroin was clearly not a possibility. Death was on the table. Instead, I took a shower. The warm water was comforting, but my mind was foggy, so I forgot I didn't have a towel. The only thing I could do was put my clothes back on, which of course made them all wet. All I did was make everything worse. Around 7 a.m., the shops opened up, so I walked into a pharmacy, asked for their strongest sleeping pills, and downed the whole fucking box. It didn't put me to sleep, it just gave me these gnarly hallucinations. The world started swirling, my brain started having conversations with itself that I was not involved in. It lasted for hours. When everyone else woke up, Dave Pollock asked me to go for a walk with him. I would hear him talking and ask, "What? What'd you say?" He would look at me confused and say, "Nothing." Still dope sick, exhausted, covered in damp clothes, having a lame acid trip, I think I passed out in a pile of dog shit on that tour. But I was drinking so heavily that most of my memories have been blacked out. Maybe I was dead already. Courtney. I returned to L.A. after the tour, and DJ and I moved into a rundown 1920s-era Hollywood apartment occupied by my friends Anna and Dana and my drug dealer Carlton. Dana's boyfriend was in a band called the L.A. Tourists. She was riding home with them from a show one night when their car ran off a cliff. Everyone in the car died except for her. 15 years later, she came to see NoFX in Hollywood, and on her way home, she was killed by a drunk driver. She left a voicemail on Fat Mike's phone just before it happened, saying how great it was to see him and Aaron at the show. They played the message at her funeral, and Mike memorialized her in a lyric in the song, Drop the World. It was on the same block as the legendary Canterbury Apartments where the Go-Go's, the Germs, and a bunch of first-wave L.A. punk bands used to live. Down the hall, there lived a girl named Courtney Love. Within 30 seconds, I knew Courtney Love was a fucking nut. I don't remember exactly how we met, but I have a vivid image of her writhing around on her back on the floor of a bar and showing off her tits. She was never shy about her body. She worked as a stripper at an L.A. dive called Jumbo's Clown Room. So named because the owner used to work at a clown and had clown memorabilia on the shelves over the bar. These days, Jumbo's is populated mostly by hipsters trying to be gritty, but back then, it was full of sweaty Persian dudes in trench coats. It was the bottom of the barrel for L.A. strip clubs, providing temporary employment for junkies like Courtney. Courtney was friends with Jennifer Finch from L7, who I was dating at the time. The three of us started hanging out and doing drugs together. We were like the three heroin-using amigos. Jennifer and Courtney made a game out of sleeping with each other's boyfriends. One night I called up Courtney because I wanted to get high, and she had a connection. We copped some dope and ended up back at her place. She won the game that night. I called Steve from Courtney's apartment to talk about band business. Later, he played me back the message I left on his machine. I'm babbling on about practice schedules or whatever, but in the background you hear Courtney say, "Bad boy. Bad boy has diaper rash. Bad boy better crawl over to mommy to get a spanking." And then you hear me sputter, yeah, bye, and hang up. She was insane, but she was fun. She wanted me to be the drummer of her brand new band, Hole. I said, fuck no. I had been to her house and listened to her twang on her guitar 100 times. She sucked. But as the years went on, her husband and her music made her famous, and her intense drug use became world-renowned. But Courtney Love once told me that I was, and I quote, the worst junkie she'd ever seen in her life. She wasn't talking about my frequency of use or my tracked-up arms. She was referring to the fact that every time I saw her, I would be barfing. I would either be dope-sick and puking from withdrawals, or about to shoot up and puking in anticipation, or just wasted and puking the booze out of my system. If I hadn't eaten, I would dry heave, or throw up bile or stomach acid. For a stretch of several years, I vomited several times a day, every day. Let that sink in a bit. The worst junkie that Courtney Love had ever seen.
Jay. Bob Lodge was a Korean junkie who pimped out his girlfriend for drug money. He was 10 years older than me, and you could see the homelessness on his face. But he was an awesome guy and a fellow dog patch wino. After a night of drinking, he and I stumbled back to my Hollywood apartment. But before we could get to my door, we somehow got separated, and Bob got lost in the building. About a half hour later, there was a knock at the door. I opened it to find Bob being propped up by this weirdo with long, straight black hair and a million piercings in one ear, a fringed black leather jacket, and Ray Charles sunglasses, indoors in the middle of the night. He looked like someone sent from the future to stop computers from becoming self-aware. Before he said a word, I assumed Bob had wrangled him up to party, because the apartment had gotten a reputation as a party pad. Anna and Dana had already given DJ and me a bunch of grief about our late-night rowdiness because they had regular jobs and, unlike us, needed sleep. I was sure we were on the verge of getting kicked out, so right away I copped an attitude and told the time traveler, "Look, no one is fucking partying tonight. Get the fuck out of here." "Fuck you, dude. I'm just bringing your fucking friend by." He had found Bob wandering the hallways and was just helping him get home. "Fuck you," I responded. Bob interjected, "Hey, man, it's cool. It's cool. This is Jay, and he's cool." It was my first time meeting my future drum tech and friend for life, Jay Walker. And our first words to each other were, "Fuck you." We almost came to blows, but after a few more words, I calmed down and they came inside. It couldn't have been more than a couple minutes later that I had bonded with him so closely that I said, "Want to see my strawberry farm?" and pulled down my pants to show my herpes blisters. I can't explain how we grew so close so quick. Our personalities fit together so perfectly that I went from wanting to beat the shit out of him to laughing and showing him my dick almost instantly. And it's been love ever since. Over the following months, we became inseparable. Jay was normally a lone wolf, but I convinced him to join the Dark Patch Winos and we'd go out drinking every night. And every night, I would get into a fist fight. I was 127 pounds and I thought I was tough. I knew I had Jay and the winos behind me, so I would start trouble just for the fun of it. Like an asshole, I would get drunk throw a sucker punch at some random person, and it would turn into a barn burner. One night I was so shit-faced and I couldn't fucking see, which sucks when you're driving a car down Hollywood Boulevard. Jay guided me with his voice as I swerved down the road. We ended up climbing onto a roof of an apartment building, and I noticed a pool on the ground floor. We talked about jumping from the roof into the pool, but weren't sure if we would make it. So as a test theory, I uprooted one of the TV antennas poking from the roof and hurled it down to the pool. We wouldn't have made it. But no test is scientific unless the results have been repeated. So a dozen more antennas went crashing down to the pool deck that night, and a lot of people probably complained to their landlord about their suddenly poor TV reception. Had those antennas not been there, I can guarantee you, I would have tested the theory with my own body, and I would not be here today. When we went our separate ways that night, Jay went to his apartment and started cooking a quesadilla, but he passed out on the floor while the stove was still on and set the apartment on fire. He woke up in a cloud of smoke, but thankfully, he was already low to the ground, so he was able to crawl out without asphyxiating himself. He needed a new place to live. Quake. When you have hepatitis, your shit turns white and your piss turns brown. Jay and I moved into a closet of an apartment occupied by a chick named Melody and several of her hepatitis-ridden, junkie friends. The toilet was broken and clogged full of white shit and brown piss, so everyone would shit and piss in the bathtub and then turn the water on to wash it down the drain. One day, a new hepatitis-ridden junkie named Eric moved into the apartment. He sang for a band called The Stains. And he went by the nickname Earache, or Earthquake, or Quake for short. Quake was 6'5", 10 years older than me, and built like a fullback, with swastikas tattooed all over his body. He looked exactly like Rutger Hauer and always reminded me of Hauer's psycho drifter character in The Hitcher. He was handsome but scary. His eyes were piercing but soulless. He was a bona fide sociopath. When I first started going to punk shows, he was the guy everyone was scared of. Those who weren't smart enough to avoid eye contact with him learned a painful lesson. He would fucking squash people. And now, he was living with us. There were rumors about him killing people and making homemade Super 8 porno with Hollywood runaways and stories of 14-year-old girls ODing in his house and dying. I had heard a story about a time when he offered some girls a ride home and then held them hostage and raped them. I would watch him shoot speed or heroin and then sit there and talk to the walls. He would be having an argument with Satan, and I would be cowering in my closet thinking, oh, fuck. But he was always really cool to me. Nice guy. Mike told me a story about Quake making a generous offer to drive him and his girlfriend Natalie home from Hollywood one night after a show. It was after 2 a.m. and the buses had stopped running, so they were about to take him up on it when Bill Bartell from the band White Flag stepped in and warned Mike that Quake was probably more interested in raping Natalie then seeing them safely home. Bill drove them home himself, and, after Mike learned more about the kind of guy Quake was, Bill earned himself a lifetime spot on the guest list for any NoFX show. That spot has been free since September 2013, however. Rest in peace, Bill. He was another incarnation of Raymond, a violent, unpredictable, criminal drug addict. But guys like that are apparently drawn to me, so we became fast friends, even though he was one of the most frightening dudes in Hollywood. Quake sometimes hung out with this tough-ass chick named Misfit, who was part of the 18th Street Gang. She did 12 years in prison for stabbing someone almost to death, but she was cool. Nice girl. One night we were all shooting dope, and Quake and Misfit ended up in the bathroom together. The noises they made sent shivers through my spine. It sounded like a violent rape, but I wasn't about to investigate or interfere, because one or both of them would have beaten and stabbed me regardless of what was actually going on. I just sat there thinking, Quake is locked in the bathroom with Misfit. She's dead now. I processed that as a reality. Misfit came around to hang out with Quake on several other occasions, so I can only assume it was either consensual rough sex, an ugly argument, or she was so strung out on drugs it was worth hanging out with her rapist. Quake eventually got arrested for something and fled to Alaska. I'd get letters from him occasionally, written under a different name. Around that time, I started shitting white. I'd become a connoisseur of vomit, so I could tell that my latest bouts of puking were coming from a different source than usual. And the fever, yellowed eyes, and jaundiced skin were hints, too. I didn't bother going to a clinic. I knew it was only a matter of time before my roommate's hepatitis became my own. In an attempt to flush it out of my system, I drank gallons and gallons of cranberry juice until my mouth blistered from the citric acid, and I snuck tablets from my roommate's medication. I didn't stop drinking or shooting dope, mind you, but somehow the symptoms slowly disappeared. Quake wasn't as lucky. Years later, when NoFX played Alaska, he came to the show and looked like a zombie. His hair was gray, he was bloated, and his legs were bright pink from his fucked up circulation. Soon after, the hepatitis killed him. Misfit is dead now, too. I'm pretty sure she had AIDS, but I'm not sure if that's what killed her. It might have been an OD or maybe murder. These were the type of people I was hanging out with. The hepatitis is still in my system. I was officially diagnosed with hepatitis C in 1999. It's in remission now, but it could flare up at any time and maybe even kill me. But all things considered, I'm fucking grateful. I was living with disease-carrying murderers, I was sharing dirty needles, I was using an infected homemade tattoo gun, and I was filling my body with the worst possible poisons. My friends were going to prison or dying from overdoses. Why was I the lucky one? When you live the junkie lifestyle, chances are slim that you're going to make it out alive. I played Russian roulette so many times. And the worst thing to come out of it was hepatitis C? I'll take it. The absurdity of it all hits me every now and then. I'll be on stage, looking out to the crowd, and my mind will wander and wonder about the horror that might have been. Or I'll be surfing and look out at the sun on the horizon and I'll think, what a beautiful day. I shouldn't fucking be here. Mark Curry. Jay Walker was a roadie from a Sacramento rock band called the Mimes. He moved down to L.A. with the band and was crashing with them, until he set their place on fire. Jay introduced me to a bunch of Sacramento musicians who would occasionally travel to L.A. for gigs. Among them was a charismatic drunk dude named Mark Curry. Like Jay, Mark immediately fit into the Dogpatch Winos and joined our nightly rampages through Hollywood. Drinking, fighting, chicks, mayhem. One night around 2 a.m., Mark showed up to my apartment with a broken hand after a fight. We took him to Glendale Memorial Hospital. While Mark was being treated, I snuck around the hallways and stole everything that wasn't bolted down. I took plasma bags and x-ray film. I ransacked supply closets and filled my pockets with totally useless stuff. I stole an electric cart and cruised through the accessways and even stole a mattress. I stuffed it all into whoever's car we were driving. It had to have been thousands of dollars worth of shit. The only thing I kept was the mattress, because I needed it for the closet floor. Everything else got tossed or dumped somewhere. Utterly pointless, destructive behavior. At the time, I was working for the LA Weekly newspaper as a runner for the art department. I would drive around town to various companies to pick up their advertising artwork or drop off proofs. It was a perfect job for copping dope. 3 hours worth of work, 8 hours to do it, and no supervisor over my shoulder. I would even steal books while I was out on the runs. A perk of the job was learning how to sneak into Universal Studios. One day I went there to pick something up and found an employee entrance that led into the theme park area. So anytime I had a delivery at Universal, I would grab DJ or another friend, and we would spend the afternoon on the rides. Once I was at a show with Mark Curry and some other winos at the Universal Amphitheater, and afterwards I showed them the door that would allow access to the park. They had an attraction called the Miami Vice Action Spectacular, which was a live-action stunt show featuring explosions and jet skis. There was a part of the show where a stuntman jumped off of a water tower onto a hidden airbag below. We snuck through the backstage entrance and took turns jumping into the airbag for a half hour and never got caught. Mark was as much of a boozer and partier as the rest of the winos. But while we were all directionless losers, Mark was ridiculously fucking talented. When he picked up a guitar and started playing, I was stunned. He played solo acoustic shows around L.A., and the music would just flow out of him. It was almost spooky how good he was. Years later, one of NoFX's most popular songs would be a punk version of Mark's song, Perfect Government. Aside from his solo shows, Mark performed in a funk rock band called Crystal Sphere. The members came down from Sacramento for meetings with record labels, and Mark introduced them around. Among them was a doughy, goofy Mexican named Aaron Abeda. He was a fashion disaster with a white t-shirt, suspenders, zoot suit pants, shiny shoes, and a stupid little fedora. I couldn't resist beating him up. I don't mean viciously. I mean like what you do to a little brother. Every time Mark would bring him around, I'd say, "Come here, you fat little beaner," and put him in a headlock and punch him until I got bored. Finally, I went to see Crystal's Fear play. They were like the Chili Peppers, but with soul, and better. I mean, way better. As much as Mark's soulful voice took over the room, I was blown away by Aaron. This little goofball had been drunkenly punching at every opportunity was an amazing guitarist and a damn good singer. Aaron had confidence. He had swagger. He was not the same person I had met off the stage. I remember thinking, oh my fucking God, that little fat beaner is unbelievable. I had no idea at the time how big a part Aaron would come to play in my life. He's a living, breathing example of how almost everything I have in this world is based on random chance. If Bob Lush hadn't stumbled into Jay, I wouldn't have met Mark, which means I wouldn't have met Aaron, which could have meant a completely different destiny for me. That first Crystal Sphere show was a life-changing moment. I just didn't know it yet. So for the next couple years, I just kept drinking shitty wine, shooting up, and beating on Aaron. But when Steve abruptly quit the band and Mike was auditioning guitarist, I said, I got a guy.
Chapter 54. Hefe. Hold the bird, hold the bird, my mom translated. What's going on? She wants you to hold the bird. A lady handed me an oversized chicken. She gave me some urgent orders in Spanish, and my mom translated once more. Hold on now. Okay, I got it. I held the bird tight. My mom smiled. The chicken lady grabbed the bird's neck and suddenly, whack, she chopped its head off. Ah! I let it go and the body went flopping and flying all over the place, blood spurting everywhere. My mom laughed hysterically. Another classic Abeta family trip to Mexico. Every year or so, my family would pile into the car and make the drive from Sacramento, California to El Paso, Texas to visit my grandparents. It's a 1,200-mile trip, and when you're 12, it seems like it's 12 times longer. And a few times, we drove an additional 12 hours to a small village just outside of Zacatecas, Mexico to visit some friends of my aunt. Zacatecas was a small, dusty town like the kind you see in old westerns. Some kids might dream of living like a cowboy, but I realized quickly that it wasn't as glamorous as the movies made it out to be. We stayed in adobe huts with no plumbing. We bathed at the local swimming hole while the women did laundry in the same water. The toilet was an outhouse with a wooden bench inside that had a hole cut out of it. You did your business with the flies buzzing all around you and wiped your ass with old newspapers. It was especially unpleasant in there when my whole family came down with diarrhea from drinking the local water. The villagers had to ride a horse and carriage into town to bring back a doctor who stuck a needle in my newsprint-covered butt. And chicken wasn't our only meal. My mom pulled me outside one day, saying, "You have to come watch this." And we all gathered around as men brought a cow into the center of the village and tied its legs together. One of the locals handed his oldest son a long knife, like it was some sort of ceremony. The son approached the cow and opened its throat. The town celebrated as the cow kicked and mooed until it passed out. They boiled the blood on an open fire and gave it to all the young boys of the village. I guess it's supposed to help them become men. They offered it to me, but I said, hell no. It was even harder to watch them kill a pig on another occasion, because every morning I would walk past its pen, greet it with a friendly, "Hey, pig," and toss it a handful of corn. Then one day there it was, strung up by its legs, squealing and fighting while they sliced it open. It made this horrible, desperate, high-pitched squeal like it knew it was going to die. When it stopped moving, they used a blowtorch to burn off the hair and peel off the outer layer of its skin. Then they fried the skin in oil in an enormous iron skillet. I was horrified by the whole process, but I had to admit, it tasted pretty good. The trip wasn't all bad. I shot slingshots with my cousins while we watched the cattle graze, and I got to ride my first horse. They even had a movie night when some guys brought in a little 8mm projector and showed a Mexican cowboy flick. They served punch in little plastic sandwich bags with straws sticking out of them. And instead of popcorn, we ate toasted pumpkin seeds served in cones of newspaper. It wasn't what I was used to, but it was fun. Still, when I was older, I refused to go back. At 16, I was way too cool to be pooping into a wooden bench, but I did agree to return to El Paso after I was promised a day trip over the border to Juarez, where I would be rewarded with a handmade acoustic guitar. I had been playing guitar for a year or two by that point, and I was starting to get pretty good. But all I had was my brother's beat-up, cobweb-covered, off-brand electric guitar, and I wanted an instrument of my own. I endured the car ride and the family time in El Paso and finally made it to the street market in Juarez. Dozens of guitars were hanging off racks, and the guitar maker was sanding down the body of his latest creation. I picked a classic blonde off the rack, but when we got back to my grandparents' house, I found that the tuning pegs were nearly impossible to turn. When my grandfather saw the guitar, his eyes lit up. He tried to talk to me about it, but he didn't speak any English. My aunts translated and told me he wanted to play the guitar. I pointed out the problem with the tuning pegs, so he took me out to his workshop behind the house and oiled them for me. When we went back inside, he tuned the guitar and played a delicate traditional Mexican song. I had no idea he knew how to play. It wasn't until we returned to Sacramento that my mom showed me a faded black and white photo of him in his old band holding an upright bass. It must have been a long time since he held an instrument, but he hadn't lost his chops. When the last note of his song rang out, he handed me the guitar, and he looked at me expectantly. I took it from him and played the most impressive-sounding tune I knew, Foolin' by Def Leppard. He let out an impressed laugh when I was done. The house was full of people chattering and talking over each other, but he and I managed to have this private moment together, bonding over music and communicating despite the language barrier. My grandfather died before we were ever able to make another trip down to see him. Playing guitar with him was definitely the moment that bonded us, but I also remember him gathering the kids around and having my aunts translate as he told stories about riding with Pancho Villa during the Mexican Revolution. I don't remember all the details so well, but Pancho Villa's men rode into my grandfather's village and told him to ride with us or die. My mom told me about a time when she was a little girl. My grandfather took her to the site of the shootout that occurred when Villa's men took over the town. My grandfather ran his fingers over the bullet holes in the walls of one of the buildings in the town square and relived the battle. My mom came from proud blood. She grew up in El Paso during an era when she wasn't allowed to sit in the front of the bus or drink from the same water fountains as white people. During her school days, someone stole something from her classroom. So the teacher lined up all the Mexican kids and whacked them with a ruler, while snarling about how they were all filthy and needed to be hosed down. So when my mom got older, she didn't take shit from anybody. One time my older sister came home from grammar school, crying about how some other girls had beaten her up. My mom went into the garage, grabbed a big-ass wrench, and said, "Let's go." They disappeared up the street. I was really young at the time, and way too scared to ask for details when they came home later. You didn't fuck with our family. Growing up in the ghetto of El Paso, family was all my mom had. If one of her brothers or sisters got fucked with, everyone else got their back. She had 8 siblings. It was like having a built-in gang. When my aunts were in their 40s, 3 of them were living together in a house, and someone broke in through a window while they were sleeping. Instead of hiding under the bed or calling 911, they confronted the burglar with whatever weapons they could scrounge up from the kitchen. The burglar stood his ground, not afraid of 3 Mexican spinsters in nightgowns. One of them tried to grab him and bam, he socked her in the face. Big mistake. My oldest aunt said, "You're gonna fuck with my family?" And she stabbed him with a barbecue fork, while my other aunt bonked him over the head with a frying pan. They swarmed him with fists, feet, and kitchen utensils, and he couldn't take them all at once. He ended up begging for mercy as he climbed back out the window. My oldest aunt skewered his ass with a barbecue fork on his way out. When I was a kid, my mom was the disciplinary of the household. The tradition of the belt was upheld in our house, and I was always incurring its wrath. A mailman stopped by our neighbor's house one afternoon, and I ran into his truck and stole some mail cart thing. The mailman saw me running away and knocked on our door. He and my mom found me hiding behind a garage, and whap came the belt. "You never steal! Whap, whap, whap!" The mailman's face went from anger to horror. "Oh my God! Please! This isn't necessary! Whap, whap, whap! Oh, I'm so sorry, kid!" He was way more traumatized by the experience than I was. In most families, when the kid does something wrong, it's wait until your father gets home. In our family, it was, "Oh, thank God Dad's here to save my life." My dad was a quiet guy. He must have experienced the same brutal racism growing up in El Paso, but I never heard any of his stories. His father got him a job on the railroads to keep him off the streets, and after my parents married and moved to Sacramento, he landed a job as a mechanic at UPS. He worked his way up to chief mechanic for the local fleet and busted his ass to support our family, which included my parents, my older brother, my two older sisters, my younger sister, and me. My mom's full-time job was her five kids, but when the summers rolled around, she went to work picking tomatoes. She would leave the house at 5 in the morning when it was still dark outside, and she would sweat under the California summer sun until my dad picked her up after work. I remember going with him to pick her up and seeing the fields, the machinery, the big conveyor belt, and the look of utter exhaustion on my mom's face. She wasn't doing it because we were broke. She was doing it to save up enough money so she could afford tuition at Sacramento State University. She earned a master's degree in social work and went on to found and direct a health clinic for low-income families. And all of this while she was contending with diabetes. I don't know how she made it through those long summers in the tomato fields when she had to take insulin shots every single day. The symptoms were sometimes so bad she'd pass out. She taught me what hard work and discipline really meant. She showed me that dreams became reality only after you put in the time and poured out the sweat. If I wanted something out of this life, it wasn't going to be handed to me. And what I wanted was to make it as a musician. My mom couldn't afford a babysitter or a nanny. And out of all five kids, I was the biggest troublemaker. If she said, "Don't touch that," she could guarantee I'd be touching it the minute she turned her back. I couldn't sit still, and Adderall hadn't been invented yet. So the only way my mom could keep me out of trouble was by playing records. Our record player wasn't a dusty turntable in a forgotten corner of the house. It was housed in a massive, stately cabinet that ruled over the living room. I would be buzzing around the house at full speed, but when my mom put on a Gene Vincent record, I would stop dead in my tracks and sit down to soak in the sound. Other parents used TV as a babysitter. My mom used music. She would be free to do the dishes or the laundry, safe in the knowledge that I was planted in front of the record player. But if she checked on me 1 second after the last track finished playing, something in the house would be broken or covered in sticky fingerprints. Every song on every album would fascinate me. And my mom had broad, eclectic taste. Calypso, rock and roll, classical, mariachi. I devoured them all. In fourth grade, my classmates and I were ushered into the school cafeteria, where one by one, we sat with a strange man and his strange machine. The machine emitted a tone, and we had to give a thumbs up or thumbs down depending on whether the sound was high or low. We listened to a series of boops and beeps in various frequencies, and it seemed like such a pointlessly easy task. But it turned out to be a test. The kids who could best differentiate between the tones were invited to join the school band. Having honed my ears after so many afternoons in front of the record player, I passed with flying colors. The band teacher asked me which instrument I wanted to play, and I picked the trumpet because that's what I'd been hearing on my mom's mariachi albums. But the school didn't have any more trumpets left to loan out, and my parents couldn't afford to rent or buy one, so the teacher said I could play the flute instead. I didn't join the band that year. When I was in fifth grade, my parents saved up enough to rent me a trumpet from Klein's Music on 47th Street. And before I even took my first lesson, I was trying to play along with my mom's records. I learned fast, and by the time I entered junior high, I was in the concert band. In high school, I added marching band and jazz band to my resume. I joined up with the elite Sacramento Freelancers Drum and Bugle Corps for a summer, and later went on to pursue trumpet all through college. So by the time I was 16, and I unearthed that beat-up, cobweb-covered, off-brand electric guitar in the back of my brother's closet, I already had a well-developed ear and the ability to read music. I wish I knew what brand of guitar it was. It vaguely resembled a Fender Jazzmaster, with sunburst coloring and three distinctive flat rocker switches. It was missing a string, so I took it over to Klein's. "I need to buy a string." "You mean strings?" "No, I just need one." The clerk suggested I buy a whole pack of strings, which sounded like a scam to me. But once he replaced all the strings and cleaned and tuned the guitar, I had to admit it sounded much better. Again, before taking any lessons, I sat down with the record player. I made marks on the neck of the guitar with different colors of crayon, so I knew which notes to play in which order for which song. After a few tips from my friends and a few lessons over at Klein's, I didn't need the crayons anymore. My friend Paul Peterson helped me learn a bit more about guitar, and I would jam with him and my friend John Cagney. We learned the first half of Purple Haze, and the first half of Dazed and Confused, and decided we were a band. We called ourselves Jack Attack. I think it was a rejected name that John Cagney's older brother's band hadn't bothered to use. None of us were named Jack. I think it was in reference to Jack Daniels. An Attack of Jack Daniels. Jack Attack only played one gig, an open house at our grammar school. It was one of those nights when parents came in to visit the school and meet the teachers, and the principal had charitably agreed to let us provide the entertainment. From behind the curtain of the multipurpose room, we heard the principal give his welcome speech to the gathered parents, and then conclude with, "All right, now we're going to break and go to the classrooms." 5 or 10 minutes went by, and then, "All right, everybody, and now we have Jack Attack." The curtains opened to an empty auditorium. The parents had moved on. Maybe 7 or 8 of our friends remained waiting to see us. Pretty smooth move on the part of the principal. We played the first half of Purple Haze and the first half of Dazed and Confused and jammed until we were tired and decided to stop. We played the whole set, if you can call it that. Sitting in chairs with our heads down, that's how we practiced. So that's how we played. Our friends in the audience thought it was the best thing they'd ever seen. But unfortunately, the legend of Jack Attack faded away soon thereafter. Music was my main obsession, but comedy wasn't far behind. I would memorize Red Fox, Cheech and Chong, and Richard Pryor albums and perform them with John Cagney and his brother Eric. I would watch cartoons with my brothers and sisters and imitate every character and act out every storyline we had just seen. I would watch the Three Stooges and imitate all three of them talking to each other. Sometimes my siblings would laugh, and other times they would give me a bewildered look that seemed to show concern for my mental capacity. Years later, I would see that same look on Fat Mike's face while doing cartoon voices in the vocal booth at West Beach Studios. In high school, I grew close to a fellow class clown named Mark Curry. We had known each other since we were little, but it wasn't until we were teenagers that I realized he had just as vast a repertoire of cartoon voices as I did. I would start an Elmer Fudd scene, and he would finish it. He could quote every Monty Python movie verbatim. We would go to the music store and study the clerks and customers, and then go home and record skits about them. Between our mutual love of art, music, cartoons, and juvenile humor, we bonded fast. Wonder Twin Powers, activate! Mark and his friends were way better musicians than me, so they rightfully laughed at my face when I asked to jam with them. But I practiced so much that I caught up to them soon enough. We were called Crystal Sphere. We blended funk and rock, and we were actually not that bad. I worked nights at a metal fabrication shop for a year, grinding welds and sanding and painting metal door frames for office buildings. It allowed me to afford a no-name brand Candy Apple Red Flying V guitar and a Yamaha G5 amp with a size 10 speaker at Klein's. Every night at the metal shop, we would listen to the classic rock radio station, and I would focus on the guitar parts and visualize the notes. I would hear Iron Man and play the main riff over and over in my head until I got home, close to midnight, and could figure it out on guitar. I would buy Van Halen albums and put them on the record player at 16 RPM instead of the traditional 33.3, so I could dissect the solos at a slower speed and perfect them. I was obsessed. I would play for hours every day. I put more time into guitar than anything else. Anything else, of course, included schoolwork. Toward the end of my senior year, I was barely attending classes, and after earning 9 days worth of in-school suspension, I dropped out just a few weeks shy of graduation. Mr. Parker, the music teacher, called me at home and begged me to at least stick around for the last few concerts the jazz band had scheduled. Once I fulfilled my commitment and handed in my marching band uniform for the last time, Mr. Parker blew up at me for dropping out, shouting, "You'll never amount to anything! You're gonna be a bum!" I shot back, "I'm gonna go to college! I'm gonna study music! I'm gonna make it as a musician!" "You're never gonna make it!" Nobody took me seriously when I said I wanted to pursue music. When friends and teachers in high school asked me what I wanted to be, I said I already knew and I was already doing it, and they all laughed. They were right to be skeptical. If there's a kid out there listening to this book and thinking about giving the finger to his or her high school diploma and trying to make it as a musician, I can tell you right now that it's a rough fucking road. It's a roll of the dice that almost never comes out the way you hope it does. There are brilliant guitarists with far more talent than me selling CDs on a subway platform right now. But don't ever let anyone tell you that you can't do something. You can do whatever you put your mind to, as long as you're willing to pay for it with every ounce of sweat you've got. Even then, the success you find might not look like the success you imagined, but what the hell? Go for it.
Chapter 55, Mike. We were packing up our equipment after a show at Gilman Street in Berkeley, when suddenly someone came up from behind me and wiped his finger under my nose. I turned around, and this creepy dude with long hair and sunglasses said, "You just got frothed." Frothing is when you wipe your ass with your finger and then wipe that finger under someone's nose. It wasn't a particularly effective froth because I didn't really smell anything. It was mostly just confusing and annoying. The finger belonged to a sleazy booze hound named Jay Walker. Jay was a friend of Smelly's and part of an L.A. gang called the Dogpatch Winos. The Winos weren't a gang in the traditional L.A. sense of punching and stabbing. They were more a merry band of drunks and junkies with an adolescent sense of humor. Frothing, for example. While most gangs are all about pride, the Winos had none. While most gangs had harsh penalties for not having a cleanly sewn patch on one's outfit, the Winos would just safety pin their patches on. They weren't about starting trouble as much as they were about scoring drugs and living a totally seedy, dirtball lifestyle. I was never invited to be a Dogpatch Wino, and they were the only gang from which I was flattered to be excluded. They thought of me as a college guy. I thought of them as hopeless alcoholics. They were mostly homeless, but they congregated at a house on Fountain Avenue in Hollywood. I hung out there once or twice, but never felt welcome. Jay Walker and his friend Bob Lush needed a ride from Berkeley down to L.A., and Smelly offered them seats in my van. Thus, Jay's gallant self-introduction. People often use the word pimp as a figure of speech, but when I describe Bob Lush as a pimp, I mean it literally. He dated a hooker who would turn tricks so they could afford drugs. Bob drank so much that his liver was horribly damaged. One day he was fighting with his girlfriend, and she threw him over a weight bench. It was apparently the last blow his organs could take. His liver burst, and his life was barely saved by an emergency surgery, which provided part of the lyrical inspiration for our song Bob. It has become a crowd favorite, but I never found out what Bob thought of it. He OD'd before I got the chance. Anyway, we were driving along when Jay shouted from the back, "Pull over! We have to pee!" I said I'd pull over at the next exit. "No, we gotta pee now!" And then I heard two streams of piss hitting the side door of the van. Zero pride also meant zero respect. Smelly brought a wino named Johnny Sixpack over to my house once, and the next thing I knew, he was spray-painting swastikas on the walls of my kitchen. Or maybe it was just the DPW logo. Or both. I don't know. Does it matter? He was spray-painting my kitchen! I avoided the Dogpatch Winos as much as possible, but still spent a significant amount of time with Jay at parties and shows. Unlike the rest of the Winos, he wasn't a total numbskull. We could have normal conversations, we could relate to each other, and he was pretty funny. Over the next 20 years, he would become a dear friend, and I would put him through more than enough to make up for all the pee in my van.
Chapter 56, Hefe. As I grew up and changed, so did the city of Sacramento. Gangs and the crack epidemic transformed the city in the 80s. The bars on everyone's windows went up so slowly, I barely noticed the transition. All my friends grew into teenage delinquents, and we all discovered booze, weed, and speed. We called our clique the Park Rats, because we would hang out at Sky Park during the day, and Garcia Bend Park near the river on weekend nights. The Garcia Bend parking lot was where things got sketchy. It was drinking, fights, and running from the cops every single weekend night. But I tried to be one of the good guys. I earned the Order of the Arrow in Boy Scouts, and was 3 merit badges short of making Eagle Scout before I quit. I studied Renbukai, a hybrid Japanese-Korean martial art, until my parents couldn't afford the lessons anymore. And for most of my junior year in high school, I was a guardian angel. The guardian angels were causing a major stir in the early 80s. Their founder, Curtis Sliwa, was all over the news as crime spiraled out of control around the country. Sliwa was a passionate guy, and the idea of a bunch of uniformed badasses taking to the streets seemed pretty cool to me. So when I caught a glimpse of a red angel's beret in a friend's backpack at school, I begged her to bring me to the next meeting of the Sacramento chapter. I met the head of the chapter, a big black dude named CB. He interviewed me about my intentions right off the bat. The angels were wary of people on power trips looking to cause trouble rather than prevent it. After he decided I was relatively mentally stable, he asked about my background and if I had any sort of fight training. I demonstrated a few Renbukai punches and kicks on a heavy punching bag, and feeling confident, I offered to demonstrate a spinning back kick. I missed the bag and fell flat on my ass. He laughed at me, but they let me join. Twice a week, I showed up for push-ups, sit-ups, lap running, and sparring. A Kenpo karate instructor taught us different moves, and about 20 of us would practice taking each other down. One day, a big buff green beret came in to help with our training. CB introduced him to the group, and then with a smile added, "And Aaron, you're going to fight him." We didn't have a lot of padding or safety gear, but we practiced medium contact and pulled our punches so we didn't hurt each other too badly. Green berets don't do medium contact. The angels all gathered around, and I charged in with a kick. The green beret instinctively blocked it, and pow! I got a left cross to the mouth and went sailing to the floor. Everyone went, "Oh!" Blood dripped from my lower lip. I gathered myself up and tried a few punches this time, but I didn't land any of them. Bam, bam, bam! Kick to the gut. Oh! On the floor again. No one could believe I stood up the third time, but I wanted one more try. Enough fucking around. It was time to pull out the big guns. I flew at him with a sidekick. The dude just jumped out of the way and boom! Smacked me on the forehead. Oh! I felt like I had been whacked with a 2x4. He had added a forehead lump the size of a silver dollar to my bloody lip. So I admitted defeat. Later, as I was cleaning my wounds in the sink, the Green Beret came up to me.
"What's your name, kid?"
"Aaron."
"Aaron, that was the name of my first love. You got a lot of heart, kid. You're all right."
And then he hugged me. From then on, he took me aside during the training sessions and worked with me personally. He taught me how to block and move better. His technique was some special forces combination of martial arts and American boxing. It was always an intense workout, and for 6 months, he pounded me into fighting shape. In order to graduate and join the street patrols, you had to fight 3 opponents at the same time. Full contact. People got the shit beat out of them. Women, too. Some tough chick would be fighting 3 dudes. She'd take a full force kick to the gut and stand back up for more. It was gnarly. I knew what was in store for me, so I trained hard and mentally prepared myself for my graduation fight. But then, Curtis Sliwa visited our chapter and saw everyone beating the shit out of each other with no pads and gloves and freaked out. So the 3-on-1 battle royales were canceled, and I joined the patrol after a mere observation of my kicking skills. My first time patrolling was during the day, so I didn't think it would be too rough until CB decided we were going to walk through Oak Park. The neighborhood was one of the most dangerous in the city, and Oak Park itself was battleground territory for all of Sacramento's gangs. At the time, it was mostly controlled by the Crips, who identified themselves by wearing blue. We walked through the park in our Guardian Angel uniforms, which were bright red. We didn't go unnoticed. Some gangsters saw us from across the park, and we heard,
Whoa, what the fuck?
CB barked.
Everybody, backs against the wall!
And whoosh, our whole troop was lined up with our backs against the brick exterior of a nearby building, which would prevent us from being jumped from behind. There were about 20 of us and about the same number of gangsters. CB walked out to meet their leader. I was scared shitless and pretty sure we were all about to get shot. CB introduced himself as the chapter leader of the Guardian Angels. The gang leader said,
I'm the Funk Lord.
There was a gang in Sacramento called the Funk Lords. These guys were all wearing blue, so I'm not sure if they were former Funk Lords or if the Funk Lords had been absorbed by the Crips, or if they just happened to wear the same colors as the Crips, or if the guy was an actual lord from the House of Funk. Either way, he continued,
We don't need you people walking through our park.
We're not trying to start trouble. We're just here to protect our community.
We don't need no protection. We protect our own people.
One of the other gang members peeled off from his group and walked down the line of angels, getting in each person's face.
Man, I'd fuck you up, man.
Then to the next guy.
Look at you with your funky little shoes, man.
Then to one of the girls.
What are you doing here? You're a girl.
Finally, he came to me.
You too cute, man. You too cute.
CB finished his chat with the Funk Lord and agreed that we would leave the park. He reached out to shake hands, but the Funk Lord just brushed CB's hand with a bandana hanging from his wrist.
That's it? You're not going to shake my hand?
That's it, my brother. Just touch and go.
We marched out of the park, and I never saw any more action on any of my patrols. It was mostly just walking around the city, and then back to the headquarters. I remember patrolling in the pouring rain one night, getting soaked, and realizing I didn't want to spend my nights that way anymore. I handed in my wings and beret. I had proven to myself I could hang with the Guardian Angels. It was time for me to hang on the other side of the law for a while. After dropping out of high school, my options for higher learning were limited, but I enrolled in music classes at Sacramento City College, along with Mark Curry, and every other dropout reject weirdo, punker, and ghetto-ass motherfucker who thought they were too cool for high school. Most of them would drop out a week after they started. I was just as much of a freak, but I took college seriously. I enrolled in every music class they offered, jazz band, concert band, piano, music appreciation, music history and literature, every voice class from opera to barbershop quartet. There was a point when I was taking 3 separate voice classes a day. I knew guitar couldn't be my only trick. The guys on MTV were all singing and playing at the same time, so I knew I had to step up. I took a full load of courses, learning about Vivaldi and Tchaikovsky and Bach, and singing in Italian and French, and working my way up from baritone to tenor while performing barbershop songs about mosquitoes.
Zing, zang, zung. Doo-wa, doo-wa. Zing, zing, zang, zung.
At night in between classes, I put in hours at the local video store. The boss was a big-time speed dealer. He sold to me, and I'd sell to my friends and my fellow students. I also had a connection through a friend's older brother. We weighed the stuff at his house, stepped on it with powdered vitamin B, and portioned it out into little bags. It's not something I look back on with pride, but I have to admit, I made slightly more than minimum wage. I took speed for a while, but wasn't a fan. It allowed me to stay up all night tweaking and jamming on guitar. But the whole time I'd be grinding my teeth and biting the insides of my cheeks. And the come down made me feel like I'd been dragged behind a truck over a road made of sharp rocks. I'd shake and sweat, and my head and stomach would be angry at me. That shit was poison. It's hard to relive some of these experiences because of the regret I still carry. The speed I was dealing destroyed people's lives. Their marriages were torn apart. They went to jail. They got shot. I cringe at the thought of my son or daughter hearing this book and learning about all the dumb shit I did when I was younger. I really can't think of a more effective anti-drug message to pass down to them than just being honest. I tried drugs. They made me miserable. I stopped doing them. The best advice would be to cut out the first 2 steps. Even with a full plate of school, work, and illegal activity, Crystal Sphere was still my main focus. Our first real gig was a battle of the bands at a club called the Oasis Ballroom. We did a couple of originals and covers of Billy Idol's White Wedding and Rats Round and Round, and we came in second place, although we suspected the voting system was rigged against us. Our second gig was at a party at this guy Eric's house. In the middle of our set, a girl ran into the living room and shouted for us to stop playing.
"He's trying to drown her in the hot tub!"
Everyone ran outside to see Eric, our host, in the hot tub with his hands around his girlfriend's neck, yelling,
"I'll kill you, bitch!"
while her arms were flailing and splashing everywhere.
"I'll kill you, bitch!"
wasn't an uncommon exclamation in our circles. I remember hanging out at Garcia Ben and watching a guy grab his girlfriend's neck and slam her head into the hood of a car. When everyone around you is jacked up on speed, you get used to that kind of insanity. Someone pulled Eric out of the hot tub, and an even bigger fight broke out, and the party was over. We packed up our gear. Soon after, we played another party at my friend Jelly's house. This time we were in the backyard, and the fight erupted inside. Middle of the set, psh! Someone goes flying through a sliding glass door. Big fight, show over, but at least we got paid. Not in money, of course. Jelly just handed us a 16th of crank, and I sold it for about $150. Jelly later got shot for stealing someone's Harley, but I think he's still alive. We hardly ever got through a full set before a fight erupted. We'd stop and wait for the fight to finish, then start again, then stop and wait again, then play more. After a while, it didn't faze us anymore. We branched out and played bar and club gigs whenever we could, and started getting paid in cash instead of crank. We even played a bonfire party for a bunch of skydivers at the Davis Airport. They didn't pay much attention to us. We didn't connect with the skydiving demographic, I guess. We recorded songs for a 7-inch and celebrated its release with a packed show full of friends and family at a rented VFW hall on a stage we built ourselves. We felt like our band was really starting to grow. And I had a plan that was going to take Crystal Sphere to the next level. A plan that would soon have me facing down the Secret Service and a 15-year federal prison sentence. Turns out that selling copies of your record to a bunch of your friends doesn't mean much when you try to convince a record store to stock your 7-inch. We pressed 1,000 copies, and none of the stores wanted them, even the independents. We walked into a Sam Goody and asked them to carry our record, and they said they couldn't unless it came through a distributor. We said, "Well, fuck you then," and walked out. We weren't very wise business people. Mark Curry's uncle's roommate was an old black blues man who not only taught me jazz chords and how to intonate a guitar, but also offered up lessons about the ugly side of the music industry. He learned things the hard way back in the 60s and 70s. He claimed the only way to get a record on the radio was to give the DJs coke or cash, which explained why we had been laughed out of every radio station in town. I hatched a plan. I would take $5,000 I had left from selling drugs and buy $25,000 in counterfeit bills. I would spread the cash around town and turn it into legit bills and use the profits to pay off radio DJs to play our 7-inch. What could possibly go wrong? My cousin had a connection with a counterfeiter, and soon we had stacks of fake $20 bills filling the trunk of my car. We took the bills to liquor stores, used them to buy $1 lottery scratch-off tickets, and pocketed $19 in real currency. Plus, we had a chance to win extra money on the side. Seriously, foolproof. We took short $3 cab rides around the city, paid with 20s, kept the change. I had a plan to drive down to Disneyland and spread the bills around the park, but we never made it out of the Bay Area. My cousin went to a flower shop, while I went into a Carl's Jr. and ordered a burger. I handed the kid behind the counter a 20, and he called his manager over.
"We're going to have to hold on to this."
"Why?"
"Well, we need to call the police."
"Can I still order my food?"
Yeah, go ahead."
I played dumb and put in my order. But the minute the manager's back was turned, I flew out the door. I ran and caught up with my cousin.
"We need to get the fuck out of here now. Give me your coat."
I took off my trench coat and put my cousin's coat and glasses on. I had my hair in a ponytail, so I pulled out the rubber band and frizzed out my hair and hoped that I looked different enough from the description the Carl's Jr. employees were about to give the cops. I told my cousin we should split up, so we took separate cabs back to where my car was parked. We made it to the car without anyone following us, and my heart rate slowly returned to normal. As we were heading out of the city, my cousin asked to stop in People's Park to buy some weed. I protested, but he was stubborn, so we pulled over, walked up to some sketchy dude, and requested some drugs. We handed him a 20. "This ain't real money." Frustrated, we agreed to walk to a store, traded in for real cash, and return. As we walked away, two UC Berkeley campus police cars screeched to a halt right in front of us. "Freeze!" The dealer took off running. The campus cops grabbed me, and my cousin bolted down an alley. One of the cars went after him. I got cuffed and tossed into the other car. "Excuse me, sir. What's going on?"
"Shut up! You're under arrest!"
"For what?"
"For participating in buying and selling drugs."
I didn't see my cousin get taken down, but as he was running, he tossed all his counterfeit 20s under a car, which the campus cops retrieved. They searched me and found counterfeit cash in my pockets as well, so they knew they were onto something bigger than just a petty drug deal. They took us to the station, read us our rights, and dropped us in separate holding cells. They interrogated us and kept asking where our car was. "I don't have a car." "What are you talking about?"
"We need to put a sticker on your car so it doesn't get towed."
"We took the bus." It was easy to run them around. One guy played good cop. "We know you drove a car. We know you parked it here. Just cooperate with us." I stonewalled him, and then in came bad cop.
"What are you going to do next? Kill the president? Do you know how serious this is? You're going to do hard federal time."
He kept repeating that phrase all night.
"Hard federal time."
Then back to good cop. "I'm doing all I can to help you here." They dragged me back and forth between my cell and the interrogation room, with a cuff squeezed on so tight they cut off my circulation, for round after round of questioning. They dangled my keys in front of my face, and after a while they convinced me that my car really would be towed without a sticker. So I told them where it was, and they left me alone for a while. They searched the trunk and found 20 grand in leftover counterfeit cash, along with 3 bags of speed. Then the Secret Service showed up. The routine was much more sophisticated. There wasn't any screaming or fake friendliness. Instead, they made me feel like I was sitting on a couch in a psychiatrist's office. I never answered any questions the